Hello, my fine friends. Welcome back to Destination Discourse. I'm host Stuart Butler, and I'm joined today with Ad Stowe Lamlaw. How are you, sir?
Pardon me?
That was you I was talking to. Ad Stowe Lamlaw. How are you?
Oh, I was just thinking I hadn't met that guy.
No,
Is
that's your
this?
Star Wars name, is what that is.
Oh, that's my Star Wars name. Okay. You know what? I should have got that. I should have understood that. That's
You
my
should have
bad.
understood straight away because I'm Stubu Hopem. Because it's you take a
That's
combination of
your
your.
personal email.
It is.
I finally
That's
get
where my
it.
Gmail account is from. So you take letters from your first and last name to make the first word. So Stubu,
Okay.
Stuart Butler, and then you take it from your mother's maiden name in the city you were born in, and that comes out for me as Harpem, and for you it's Lamlaw. So there you go.
Okay, so hold on. I want to make sure I get Ad Stowe Lamlaw. I must be from some weird planet in Star Wars. That's
Yeah,
a
probably
strange
so.
name. Yeah.
Exactly. And we're joined today with a gentleman. I don't know his Star Wars name, so we'll use his Earth name. It's Chris Fair. How are you, sir?
Yeah, great. Pleasure to be with you today.
Hold
So,
on,
and so
Chris. I want to see if you could if you're good at puzzles. I need you to tell us your Star Wars name based on the exercise Stuart just took us through.
I know his first name. It's Chifar, right? Because it's the first three of your first names are Chris, so Chi. First two of your last name, so Fair turns to Far, so Chifar is your first name, and
You're
then
removing the A or the R though. Shouldn't it be
oh,
Kerr?
Krifar, sorry,
Yeah. You
Krifar.
see,
I
when
don't
you
even know
get
my
to
Star
the Star
Wars.
Wars fandom that I'm at and the level that I'm at, you'll be able to put those together a lot faster.
That's probably right. I don't think Chris is impressed at this conversation. I don't think any of our audience is
I
impressed.
think the last name would be Robot if I took my mother's maiden name and the city I was born in.
That's pretty Star Wars sounding, right?
Yeah. Careful,
Krifa,
robot. I guess
Krifa
so.
Robot. Yeah, that's a Star Wars. So we want everyone in the destination to send us their Star Wars names.
Yeah,
It's a fun little game.
I like it.
And tell them that Stubu Hopem sent you. So there you go. I don't know why we did that just now. It has nothing to do with the episode. I just thought it would be kind of fun. We hadn't recorded in a while, and so here we go. But today we've got a good episode. It's a great episode, in fact, because Chris's organization puts out a study every year. We're going to talk about that in a brief moment, but it's going to look at three dimensions of cities, right? So it's livability, lovability, and prosperity, and then it rank orders these cities. And this year, you not only got large cities, but you've also got smaller cities. And I'm proud to say Myrtle Beach has made the top 10. We're number five on the list. This is not going to be self-promotional for the study or for Myrtle Beach, but we're going to talk into what makes a city great and whether or not DMOs maybe have the formula wrong in terms of does it really start with a visit? Is that still true as it once was? And so we're going to dig into that. But before we do, Chris, this is your first time on the show. And you're in
Buckle
for a
up,
treat
Chris.
because it is time for the greatest segment in all of destination marketing. It's time for
Can't
Stu's
wait.
News.
No dancing.
He's
Chris
pretty
is not
stoic.
jiving
Chris
with
is a
it.
stoic kind of guy.
News, yeah.
It's the polite Canadian in him. That's what it is. Or maybe he's just got taste and he decided that, no one should be dancing to that.
It's trippy, I'll give you that.
Trippy is a good word for it, for sure. And I got to tell you, Adam, I just got back. We had Carolina Country Music Festival in Myrtle Beach this past weekend, largest or one of the largest country music festivals in the country. And, we had all kinds of amazing artists there. And I got to tell you, every single one of their songs was better than your jingle. It was great. So your jingle's
They just don't
terrible.
get the genre.
They don't. We tried to get Post Malone to sing it, but he refused flat out. So,
Wouldn't that just be epic?
yeah, it would have been great. No, I don't think it would. Epic's not the word I would use. But today, Stu's News, we're still on the AI hype train because I don't know about you, Adam, but Claude has changed my life. It's changing our organization's life. We actually had an executive leadership team this past week, and we decided we're all in. We're gonna follow up on what we've been talking about on this show. We're gonna hire a dedicated internal resource to do nothing but focus on building skills and training programs for AI. So we've got a short-term plan for that, where we're going to get a consultant in to help us sort of map out what the long term is, but then we're going to hire a dedicated resource. We've already figured out where we're shifting budget from. Like, we're fully on. And as you know, Claude has changed my life. I texted you this week that now me publishing an episode of this show has gone from being like 30 minutes to under 10 minutes, because I'm using Claude Cowork to automate most of it. And so I still actually have to do the physical editing for now, but at some point I won't. And but all the posting stuff is all completely automated at this point. And so it's game changer, and we're rolling that out to every aspect of us. But ChatGPT and OpenAI, not to be outdone by Claude and what they've done, they've realized, they've seen this trajectory that's happening in terms of the revenue that Claude had, or the Claude's getting, and they're doubling down on the business side. So Financial Times just came out with an article that says that the ChatGPT interface as we know it is going to go away from being a chat, and it's going to be more multimodal. It's going to be a super app, more similar to what Claude's doing with Codex, which is their version of Claude Code, and image generation and other stuff really prominent in that. So I think you're seeing now this next generation of AI interface, which is going to be way more utility for us, way better tools for us. But now I think ChatGPT has realized that just going after the consumer was probably a mistake in terms of short-term revenue, and now they're going hard at the business consumer. So, Adam, what do you think about that?
Well, you started your description by saying not to be outdone. And I would actually push back on that and say that is a pretty good indication that they've been outdone if they're modifying their interface to make it much more like Claude. And it's just such an indication that when innovation happens, it's not always the first to market that is going to end up being the very best one. You've talked about this on the show, that it was AOL when we first started web searches, and Google wasn't even really a thing at that point. And it's been fascinating to watch the adoption that ChatGPT got compared to the trajectory of Claude today. And I think it's a smart move on the ChatGPT side of things to try to pivot and emulate some of the things that have made Claude successful. It'll be fascinating to see if they'll be able to catch up and close the gap, and I don't know. I'm kind of fascinated to see where it goes. I don't know if the consumer wants a super app in the way enterprise customers do. And so if ChatGPT is unable to get the enterprise clients that they're looking for, I almost worry that they may end up in no man's land, but we'll see. I'm interested to watch it.
Chris, you have a take on this one, since you've been so prepared on this topic and you heard about it 30 seconds ago? I don't know if you had a take.
Yeah, well, we actually ran at Resonance, we partnered with Microsoft, and we ran a Future of Place Marketing in the Age of AI lab a couple months ago at the Microsoft Innovation Center. It was interesting. I do think there's a big difference in terms of the consumer adoption of this platform versus the enterprise. And this is probably the reverse of the internet, where we all jumped on, we built our websites. And it probably took us a decade to convince our customers to put a credit card into a computer to make a purchase. This time around, the consumer's way ahead of us. So it's great in your organization, you're dedicating resources. We're catching up, frankly, to the fastest adoption of a new technology that's ever occurred in history. So this is an interesting time to be in the destination marketing space, or marketing, or of any kind for that matter.
Or to just be alive, right? I think one of the things that stood out to me on the report in the Financial Times was they talked about super apps being more prominent in the interface. And the specific example they gave was Booking.com being one of the premium super apps. And so that obviously can potentially be an existential threat to DMOs if people are increasingly going to one brand to research and transact their vacation. So I think that's what we're trying to stay ahead of. And I'm 100% convinced that we've tried internally, and we've got some sophisticated people to adopt AI at the level at which the technology exists, and we're so far behind. The capabilities that exist far exceed our ability to adopt them. And so what we've seen is this sort of disparity between the super users and the average users. And so we've got to figure out a deliberate strategy to move the folks that are at a zero to a one, the ones to a twos, and so that we're raising the floor for everyone. And I think this past week, we got to that realization and said, without a dedicated resource that this is their job, it's not fair to expect everyone who has different skill sets and different comfort levels with technology to adopt at the same pace without someone that's there training, building the skills, setting the standard operating procedures and stuff like that. I think it's inevitable at some point there'll be a layer within every organization similar to IT. Maybe it's part of CIO's responsibility, but someone or some team is going to be dedicated to this sort of how do we maximize utilization of AI? I think it's inevitable.
Well, and if you think about it, IT is one of those jobs that are supposedly threatened by AI, that AI will eliminate. But if you think about the pivot that could happen for that entire category, it's a conversion from IT to AI administration, and it seems like a pretty logical pivot there.
Yeah, but there's some frick there's tension here, right? Because IT's job is to build infrastructure, but it's also to protect an organization, you know, especially from security, from redundancy, from data, right? There's a lot of jobs that are very sort of non-sexy jobs from a lot of people. And then you got the folks on the marketing team or the other where they're a little cavalier and they're trying to use this stuff to do crazy new innovative stuff. And so there's a tension there. And I think what we've seen is if it's just IT mentality approaching AI, it's going to stall things. It's going to slow things down because risk averse is probably their biggest motivation. And so it's got to be a blend of visionary and you know, this sort of conservative approach as well. So I don't know. It's just IT. I think you've got to have the more creative side as well.
Yeah, when I say a pivot, I definitely don't mean like just the same people with the same
Yeah, don't
skills
hand it
or in the
over.
same
Yeah, okay.
seat. They need to learn to do this. They need to develop those skills, but it just seems like such a natural place for that job category to go.
Well, there's a technical, logical sort of approach to it, right? Which is very
Yeah.
similar to IT. So that makes sense. All right. Well, let's shift gears. Let's talk about something that we talk so much about AI on this show, but I'm really excited to talk about this today because it's an area that I'm really passionate, and that is sort of placemaking, it's community development, it's economic development. But Chris, if you don't mind starting talking about this study that you guys do, remember we're going to totally call you out if you start promoting it, self-promoting and self-serving. So we really want to understand it from a psychological perspective. Like what why does this thing exists, and what are you trying to demonstrate with it? Like, what's where's the genesis of this?
Yeah, well, the you know, Residents Created the Best Cities reports. We started this 12 years ago with a very unsexy name. It was the U.S. Place Equity Index in its first incarnation, which was really a consulting tool. You know, what we were looking for was how do you benchmark the experiential quality of one place versus another? You know, there's core statistics on visitation, expenditure, but not on experience. And we developed the idea of mining user-generated data to do that. And that's evolved over time into what is now the World's Best Cities Report, the America's Best Cities Report. And the goal was really filling a void of how do we understand and measure the quality of the experience in one place versus another. That really is our lovability score. And then, of course, we look at livability and prosperity, which are more familiar to people as you think about quality of life in a particular place, and as well as you think about the economic power and productivity of one place versus another.
Yeah, so let's talk about lovability specifically for a while. What are some of the KPIs that go into measuring lovability?
Yeah, so we look at a number of very good or excellent restaurants, nightlife experiences, parks and recreation, museums, arts and cultural performances. And then we also look at, in terms of social metrics, in mentions in Instagram, likes on Facebook, TikTok videos, etc., references on Google. So it's a function of both the experience and then how much are people talking about those experiences in digital channels.
Yeah, and what I love about that is it's both the product side and it's the perception side, right? So it's like the reality, but also like how things exist in the zeitgeist. So Obviously, there's some shifts this year. Are you seeing trends? Are you seeing anything that jumps out to you in terms of the folks that are moving up in this list, like where they're making the biggest moves, what the opportunities are there?
Yeah, it's interesting to look at the cities because we're now measuring perception with Ipsos. Where do people want to live? Where do they want to visit? What cities do they think have the best job opportunities? And there are some perception moves more quickly than performance. So there can be particular events, things that happen. Provo or Adam, where you are, was perceived as was rising up, and it's dropped down in the last couple of years. So I think there was a
People found
moment.
out Adam lived there. I think that was the
It was
problem.
just that. Wow.
Yeah. Well, the spike was when I got here.
Okay,
How
there you
long
go.
you lived there? I felt like.
So the aura is faded, I guess. But so interesting, yeah, to look at some of those, what drives perception. There's really only 11 cities that we've looked at in the last 3 years whose perception has risen both as a place to live, as a place to visit, and where people think job opportunities are. So monitoring that, looking at the disconnect between performance and perception is also really where the real insights are. Does a particular city have a marketing problem or challenge, or do they have a product challenge? That's really what we look at from
So
the results.
can we use Provo as an example then? I'd love to know what part of the scoring rubric changed that caused it to kind of lose its place.
Yeah, I think that was, really just on perception dropped. It's now ranked in the latest survey 125th as a place to live. But performance-wise, it's 45th. So our data tells us that Provo is a great place, top 50 city to live in. But now the perception of that dropped off. And that may just be that other cities moved up, right? That bumped it out.
But
And
if
then
you're
you
going to
can.
diagnose a problem, based on what I'm hearing, most likely a marketing problem. Obviously, other cities moved up or whatever, but if the gap between the actual experience and the perceived experience is that significant, usually that's got to represent either a brand or marketing problem.
Yeah, exactly. So Provo is top 50 as a place to live, top 50 for prosperity. We know the economic story of Provo, but that story has either isn't getting out there or it's faded because it, ranks 115th in the perception as a place for job opportunities, 124th as a place to visit, and 125th as a place to live. So yeah, we would look at that and say, hey, there's a marketing opportunity here because there's some real strengths to Provo. How does that story get developed and shared, with the rest of the country?
And some of that too, Adam, I'd add a third sort of piece to the equation, which is the civic pride that the local, because that can really change that perception side, right? We deal with this in every city, but Montauk Beach is not immune to it. But there's a vocal minority of folks that turn negative on your locale, and that influences the perception more than the actual marketing you're doing, And so I think you've got to increasingly, as a DMO or any kind of economic development related organization, whether that's a chamber, whether that's actual economic development corporation, you're all invested in making a great, not just a great place to live, but fostering that sense of pride in the place that you live from the residents as well.
Yeah, and that's really where perception starts. We were just in St. Louis last week. That's a city that has a large perception deficit, and that perception deficit starts with the view amongst citizens that St. Louis is a place that's declined. They've done a fantastic I Am St. Louis initiative headed by the Historical Society, which is interesting, to really try and bring out the stories and reignite that civic pride, because you can't change perception externally before you've changed it internally.
So one of the things that stood out to me in this study is, and do you want to tell people real quick where this study can be downloaded? So if they want to sort of just look through it when Adam's talking, they can.
You can go to resonanceco.com/reports and you'll find it there, on our website. Or you can visit worldsbestcities.com, where you can find all of the reports as well.
Great. Thank you. So one of the things that stood out to me was it the same things people are looking for when they're deciding where to live are they're the same as what people are looking for when increasingly when they visit. You know, these aren't decoupled like they once were. In this old paradigm where it's, hey, we create a great place for people to visit, and they'll come and they'll get a taste, and then they'll want to move and live. I felt like that's sort of that's come together now into to sort of one and the same thing. Like, I don't think they're separate anymore. I don't think it's, hey, we're doing tourism promotion and someone else is doing talent attraction. I feel like increasingly we've got to work together because the things that people care about on both sides of that equation are the exact same thing. Are you seeing that same trend?
Yeah, there's no question that, you know, our data and the results show that being a desirable place to visit does indicate and drive perception of where people want to live in the United States. There are many places that are considered desirable places to visit that people want to live in that actually aren't that livable. And that is what that also tells us is that livability by itself, in terms of quality of life, is not driving perception and attraction. So job opportunities and desirable as a place to visit are driving where talent and visitors alike want to go.
Yeah. So if the livability side in the perception is driven as much now by the residential side as it is the visitation side, then should we as DMOs start looking at different KPIs, you know, beyond the traditional, like a lot of DMOs, they're so hyper focused on occupancy and tax collection and stuff specifically tourism related. Are there other things that DMOs should be looking at in addition to the tourism related KPIs? And what are they?
Yeah, 100%. I think we focus, the DMOs focus on visitor attraction, filling the hotels, meetings, conferences, events. What they don't do a good job of is developing the actual experience. So they tend to view themselves as the promoter of those, you know, of what are the experiences that exist today. And if you're, you know, have a good perception and a good product, you know, maybe that is the only job. But for a lot of destinations, there is a product deficit. And that's where you're looking at and saying, if we're going to sustain the position we have and the reputation that we have, we actually need to invest in the experience, or we're going to eventually, you know, people will discover that maybe we're not all we're cracked up to be, or maybe there'll be too many visitors relative to the number of experiences we have, and that experience and reputation will degrade over time. And that takes a whole different set of skill sets. That's not a marketing skill. You know, that's actually economic development, investment attraction, product development, experience management. And there are very few DMOs that are actually equipped with those skills.
So, Chris, do you, as part of this report, do you have kind of a map at the end or something like that that says, okay, if this is the deficit that you have, whether it's livability, lovability,
Prosperity.
or prosperity, like what levers should you pull as a destination? Like, do you take it that far in the report where you almost have a rubric that maps to the action that could come from the deficit so that these DMOs could actually understand, okay, what levers should I be pulling here?
Absolutely. We have really a simple scatter plot diagram, and you can look at there's three types of cities in the US and in the world. There are those cities where perception and performance are in balance, you know, as in they have the reputation they deserve. There are those cities that have a perception deficit, where we know the product is better than people perceive it to be. So that's a marketing challenge. That's a marketing opportunity. And then we have those cities where perception actually exceeds performance. So if that's not a, they don't need to do more marketing. What they need to be focusing on is product development, investment attraction. Of how do they fulfill the perception and the promise that they've created? And I think that's not really well understood that DMOs, there are kind of these three different types of cities and destinations that require three different areas of focus.
So if you were the mayor of a town or the head of the CEO of a DMO or a chamber of commerce, for each of those three buckets, livability, lovability, and prosperity, what are the top two or three KPIs you would be measuring and talking about most with your constituents, with your stakeholders? So let's start with lovability.
Yeah, so when we try and when we measure lovability, you know, we're looking at culinary experiences. We're looking at nighttime experiences. We're looking at parks and recreation, family fun attractions and activities. And we're also looking at user-generated data in TripAdvisor, Google, Instagram, et cetera, in terms of how they're being mentioned. So for me, it really is focusing in on, what I call the software of the city. What are those actual experiences, activities, and how do you stand up relative to your competition? You don't necessarily, when you look at our rankings, you're looking at them in the context of against all cities in the United States, 393 MSAs. We can take a more regional approach. If you're a small city in Michigan, you're not competing with cities in California. You need to look at that within a Michigan context to unlock those insights to focus on where are we competitive, where are we deficient, and those deficiencies are the areas that you should be focusing on from a product development perspective.
So is there one specific area you should focus on first? Like you mentioned, restaurants. Is the culinary scene usually one of those sort of lead indicators to growing lovability, or is that a lag indicator? Where?
Yeah, culinary is one. I think nightlife is actually one of the key areas. We've been able to look at and see a strong correlation between the number of quality nighttime experiences and business formation. So we can almost go into Google and see how many nighttime experiences there are, the growth from one year to the next, and forecast how many businesses will be formed in that particular city. So that's not to
Interesting.
say that nightlife is causing businesses to form, but that there's a symbiotic
Yeah,
relationship
correlation there, yeah.
between where entrepreneurs and businesses are being created and what the quality of the nighttime economy looks like from an experience perspective. So those are some of the kinds of insights that we can get into and try and communicate that the value of livability is not just about tourism, it's actually a catalyst for economic development.
We had Bill Geist on the show some time ago, and he talked about, I forget the destination he talked about, but they had hired someone specifically to be focused on nighttime business. Like that was their only job. They worked non-traditional hours. They worked during the evening so they could interact with the businesses during the nighttime, and they saw the value in fostering that side of the economy. And so I've only heard that one time from Bill. I haven't seen that as a trend, but it's something I think it would be worth investigating for sure,
Yeah,
given
several
the
cities. I mean,
biz.
Amsterdam was the first, more than a decade ago, to create a night mayor position. Many other cities have
Nightmare. That's funny.
done that now, and developed a nightlife strategy. There's a big
I'd
difference though
argue
between
a lot of
nightlife and
destinations
nighttime.
would say they have a nightmare, but
Yeah, I was gonna say
different
you really
there.
got to enunciate if you're the night mayor, because if you say your title is the nightmare, it's much less appealing.
Indeed.
I show the town of Halloween, or the city of Halloween in South Carolina. Well, that's great. So let's move on to the livability. Like, what are the things that you're seeing in terms of what are the KPIs that people should be looking at there, and how can we have an impact?
Yeah, one of the metrics that we added just coming out of the pandemic, well, two metrics was walkability and bikeability. Prior to 2020, we didn't have those as metrics, but in our research, we started to see that there's a correlation where prime age population was growing fastest in the places that had good walkability and bikeability. So I think those are two key metrics that are quite obvious in European cities, but less so in the US.
Yeah, for sure. So you're saying if you were part of placemaking, like investing in trails and bike paths and things like that, would probably be a smart place to start.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then prosperity, what are you looking at there as the main KPIs and
Yeah, we look at key metrics in terms of, labor force participation, incomes, et cetera. But I think, we're also measuring convention center size, airport connectivity. So some of those assets that you might think of as tourism assets, we actually see them as key catalysts for economic development.
Yeah, driving economic growth. Yeah, that makes sense. So overall, in terms of the results this year, I mentioned Model Beach is in the top five on the small cities, and we rank pretty well for lovability and livability. Where we drop off a little bit is on the prosperity side, more because we don't have as diverse an economy as a lot of places. We don't have a ton of white collar jobs, and I think that's something that our local not just elected leaders, but business leaders are realizing is probably a weak underbelly for us. Like the average, the median household income, the average house pricing. Like there's a lot of stuff that on the prosperity side you could look at and say, hey, we probably need to work on this. And so what we're seeing is an increasing collaborative spirit to our community where everyone wants to try to tackle the same problem together versus individually and in silos. And I think it is what, and this was really apparent in your report, I think, because it's the culmination of the three sort of sides of the entire ecosystem. One is the visitor economy, right? One is economic development in the traditional sense, and the other is community development. And so I think what we're seeing is, at least on the rankings that you guys put out, the communities that have figured those three pieces out together and are working more collaboratively tend to rank higher and are getting better perception and obviously better results as it relates to that. Are you seeing the same thing?
Yeah, I think that's the key. I mean, that really is the future of cities, is the cities that will win will be the cities that break down those silos, because there is a real convergence. And I think that is one of the lasting effects coming out of the pandemic, was the synergy between the factors that are attracting people to visit, are factors that are attracting businesses, that are factors that are attracting talent. Those used to overlap a little bit, but they've now converged to become one and the same.
So I actually want to ask Stuart a question here, because Stuart, you recently have made a big change in Myrtle Beach where you guys have kind of facilitated some of this convergence, right? And getting multiple organizations at the table. I mean, how far should destination marketing organizations across the board go when thinking about converging economic development and destination marketing? And to me, that seems like a political minefield, and not every
It is.
destination has the ability to do it. But when you really think about what is the goal of destination marketing, you cannot decouple it from economic development, which means those two organizations should be working hand in hand. But how official should it be?
I think it has to be superficial, but I think it starts with a mindset shift, right? And I'll use a board analogy because I think everyone will get this, right? There are people that come onto your board of directors, whatever your organization is, and they come in with their outside hat on, right? So if I'm a builder or I'm a hotelier or a restaurateur or whatever, when I come into the boardroom, I come in with that hat on, and every decision I make and every argument I make is from that one perspective, right? The better board members, the ones that are going to have more of an impact on the community, the ones that come in and they take off their external hat and they put on their organizational hat and say, hey, when I'm representing the board, I'm going to do what's right by the community, even if in some cases it's not in my best interest as a business owner, right? And so that's the kind of board member we seek, the one that's looking out for the greater good and believes that in on the long term, that's going to be healthier for the community, even if in the short term I might suffer, in the long term that's better for my business, right? So this more altruistic approach. DMOs have to approach everything that way, right? And so we've got to go into every conversation not trying to defend our territory, not trying to say this is our money, these are our resources, and we're in charge, and we're the smartest in the room, and this is our strategy, and we'll tell you how to do it. They've got to go into every conversation in a collaborative mindset and fighting equally for your partners as you are for yourself. And I'll give you an example, right? So right now we're doing a community-wide strategy. It was born out of our, so if you remember, our organization is structured. We have the Greater Myrtle Beach Collaborative, under which sits three primary organizations, but some secondary organizations too. But the three primary are the Myrtle Beach Area Chamber of Commerce, which is the regional chamber, Visit Myrtle Beach, which is the regional DMO, and Partnership Grand Strand, which is our nonprofit foundation for the organization. So the Partnership Grand Strand is the entity that's catalyzing funding a community-wide strategy called Collaborate 2031. But we're not steering it. We've hired the consultant who's doing a phenomenal job, and we're, doing surveys of the residents. We're doing focus groups, one-on-one interviews, but there's a steering committee which is made up of local mayors, city managers from all over the region, business owners, residents. Like, it's a real mix. They're the ones shaping the strategy, not staff, right? And so I think that's, we're going to take our hats off. But we've said, and we're identifying some problems, right? So, for example, one of the, and I don't want to get too far ahead, but I think one of the likely strategies that will come out of it is Muller Beach needs to diversify, attract younger workers, and diversify its economy through white collar jobs. And probably a result of that will be we'll need to build more Class A office space, right? So let's say we get to that point. There's probably going to need to be incentives put in place to catalyze some of that, right? And we don't offer incentives for that kind of things, but what we may end up doing is doing some fundraising as a community led by Partnership Grand Strand and fundraise and give that money to another third-party entity, maybe our economic development organization here, which isn't part of the collaborative, right? And so I think we've got to start looking at things holistically and altruistically, not as how do we get our own piece. We've got to take the ego out of it completely and say what's good for the community is where our energy should go. That's how you get
So
alignment.
let's go through a thought exercise here real quick and pretend we're destination X that needs some support from economic development in order to increase the livability or the lovability of the destination. But legislatively, we're not connected to economic development. And let's say that we don't necessarily have the level of relationship with the economic development team that we need to in order to collaborate at the level we need to do it. How do you start? How do you start having those conversations? How do you even get the right people in the room? And Chris, I definitely open this up to you as well to respond.
Yeah, I think that there's no one size fits all solution. Sometimes those can be just a memorandum of understanding that the organization's kind of publicly working together. There are other examples where the EDO is hiring the DMO to do their marketing that I've seen. And there are other examples, particularly in smaller cities, where you actually look at merging these organizations together. And that usually takes some civic leadership, at the top, whether that's the mayor or otherwise, to kind of force those collaborations to happen. My experience is it's more successful top down if it's driven by civic leadership than bottom up of organizations just deciding that, hey, we're going to shake hands and work together. Doesn't necessarily generate the same result.
Yeah. And I think it's got to start with trust, right? You've got to start with relationships. You've got to go break bread with people. You've got to have a set of core values that are aligned in an ultimate purpose that aligns, right? If you can all sit in a room and agree, hey, at the end of the day, we're all, whether we're in community development, economic development, or tourism development, we're all aligned. We want to drive prosperity and quality of life for our community, right? I think all three of those are doing the same, ultimately want the same outcome. So I think you agree on that to start with. Now, we might do it in different ways, but we got to stop the territorial fights. We got to stop worrying about who has power, who has influence, because the reality is, if the CEO at the DMO, the CEO at economic development, the CEO at any kind of placemaking organization all have influence over city councils and county councils, then when all of them are aligned and going to these people, then they're going to get way more accomplished. And so we've got to put the ego aside, put the territory and power and money aside, and start doing what's good for the community.
Okay, so what I'm hearing from both of you then, from a tactical perspective, again, if it's a destination marketing professional that wants to make this happen but doesn't know where to start, to me
Relationship.
it sounds like the starting point would be the mayor or whoever kind of the senior community person is to
Maybe.
because if you don't have them on board, how are you going to get tourism and economic development working together if you don't have the kind of senior
No,
leadership
I
that you
don't think it
need?
starts with the elected officials. I think it starts with the senior leadership at the organizational levels, right? So I think the
It's like
CEO
city
of the chamber.
manager.
No, the CEO of the chamber and the CEO of the DMO and the CEO of the economic development. Like, I think those are the guys that need to, or gals that need to fundamentally agree that they're on the same mission and stop worrying about who's in charge and who gets the credit. Like,
And
that's the
oftentimes,
biggest thing. That's is
off.
worrying about who gets credit. That's where a lot of things go awry.
oftentimes that mission and can be coalesced around those city in those cities where, perception is lagging performance and they have a clear perception deficit. It's easier to rally those partners together to say, hey, we should work together to change that in terms of our brand, our image. And we've worked several times and seen cities, whether that's, in Houston or Roanoke, or Hershey, Harrisburg, where economic development and destination marketing have come together to try and address that particular issue and tell a more cohesive story. Doesn't mean they don't have their own messages, their own brands, but they're developing a unified positioning and narrative. And that's the ground
Well,
floor.
and let me tell you what destination marketers who try to do this are going to give up then. What you're going to give up is your convenient defensibility, right? Where it's like, well, hey, listen, I don't have control over product. So I'm doing the best I can to market what we have as a destination, but since I don't have control over product, that's economic development's department, right? And the economic development, same thing, right? Going back the other direction. So, Stuart, when you say everybody really needs to kind of give up the ego side of things or the credit side of things, you also have to give up a little bit of the defensibility comfort that you
Yeah.
have as well. And everybody needs to be kind of thinking that through.
For sure, right? But that you're sort of pointing out one of the biggest flaws of the DMO space, right? Is a lot of times we focus so much on how do we defend our current position, the status, we don't want to disrupt the status quo, which is why we're risk adverse. We don't want to get defunded. We're not going to take risks and potentially fail because we're worried about being called out or doing something wrong or the wrong elected official, yada, yada, yada. I think the world is changing at such a rapid rate, and in certain destinations are getting so sophisticated at this that if we don't start thinking more holistically, then that very behavior is going to be what makes us obsolete. Because it goes back to one of the recent conversations we had on this show, which is like, with Gary, where he talked about like who's going to come to your defense. Like, if you're not really providing value to the community, if you're only worried about the perception of value, or you're only worried about the protecting your power structure, you're not really creating real value, and no one's going to come defend you when it's time to defend you. But guess what?
Yeah.
If you're providing real value to economic development and to chambers and to your association of realtors and to every other really important organization within your downtown placemaking, if you're providing daily value to those people because you're a real collaborator and you're driving change in a positive way aligned with them, every one of them is going to come and defend you, and it's going to be really hard to lose. So you can't be defensive anymore. You've got to go out on the offense if you're a DMO.
I
Time
like
to
it.
pick up the sword, drop the shield. Just let's go.
Chris, any reaction to that?
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And not every destination's leadership is equipped to do that. And I think, that's where you see some leaders that are stronger, more willing to take the initiative. They get the value of it, of cooperating, of drop the shield, pick up the sword. And others don't have the skill sets to do that. And I think
Yeah.
that's one of the challenges. And maybe that as you think about the evolution of the role of leading a DMO, that it's going to evolve and shift more towards the profile of what Stuart's talking about.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of folks in positions that I would consider across the country that I would consider weak leaders, right? They're the ones that are sort of ego driven and they're worried about their personal glory and their personal status. I think that's a profile of leader that was successful for a long time, especially in the DMO industry, but in other industries too. I think that profile is going to become obsolete in this new world era. I think we
Well,
have to be team builders and collaborators and bridge builders. Like that has to be the primary trait of a good leader moving forward.
and how do you know if you're that person? Have you surrounded yourself with people that you think are better than you, or people that you think you are better than? And I don't mean
Yeah.
better as like a person, but I mean like
Yeah.
talent and ability within specific roles. If you don't see the team around you as better than you at the things that you've hired them for, you're probably the weak leader.
Yeah, 100%. Do you have agency? Are you looking at everything as opportunity or as a threat? If everything's a threat around you, you're probably a weak leader. If you're looking at op nothing but opportunity and how you can help others and they can help you, you're going to be just fine. So, Chris, we're getting a little low on time. And do you have any sort of final thoughts or takeaways from this study? And then we'll give you an opportunity to shamelessly plug it again.
Yeah, no, I think that hopefully the value of, reading our reports and the insights that come with that is that we're helping organizations break down those silos, not just from a destination marketing perspective, but whether that's the economic development organization, whether that's the chamber, whether it's private sector partners or municipal leadership, and creating the data that helps back that up so that, this idea about breaking down silos isn't just lip service, that, we have data to back that up of, why this is valuable and why you should be rethinking your approach. That's the first step. Second step is doing the work, right? And making sure that you've diagnosed what is the work to be done. And I think that's the other piece that we're able to diagnose through this, whether it's a brand and a marketing challenge, which DMOs are well equipped to address, or is it a product development, destination development challenge, which I would argue most DMOs are not well equipped, to deal with. Or if you're sort of those cities in balance, it's a combination of both. So I think understanding there's not a one size fits all approach. The philosophy may be the same, but the action that needs to be taken varies from one type of city to the next. And I think that's where we can help destinations really understand what game they need to be in to begin with.
Yeah. And I think in a lot of cases, not only is the game going to be played a little differently, but who plays what role in the game is going to be different. And so that's where I think we've got to, as an industry, start to agree on, hey, here are the things that every city needs. Here's the prerequisites. Here's the things that it's the baseline. Here's the things unique to us. And then let's look at is some organization, whether it's us or not, is some organization overseeing this and making sure it's great? In what resources do they need? And how can we be a part of the solution to that? Even if we're not the primary driver of it, how do we support the folks that are and make sure that it's happening? So I think if we really adopt this mindset as, hey, we're stewards of the community in a way, and we're teammates with everyone else that are stewards of the community, then our job is less about what are we doing and more about is it getting done? And so when it's not getting done, let's figure out how to get it done, whether it's internally, externally, whether we need to help find money for people or resources for people, whatever it is. Like that's, I think that's the mentality that we've seen be successful in some destinations and that we're increasingly adopting here in Myrtle Beach. And I'll tell you, it's working because we recently had, this is the first time we've done it since I've been in this organization, but we brought together all of our local municipalities' mayors together in a room. I don't know that they've ever really met before, but just talking about what are their individual problems. And we were seeing them nodding heads and saying, oh, I didn't realize that was a problem for you because it's also a problem for us. And seeing them collaborate. And one of the folks in the room said, I really like this new sense of community collaboration. We've never tried it before, but it looks like it's going to work. And when you start to hear the leaders saying stuff like that, it's like, okay, this has got a real chance of being successful. So we're very excited about it. So Chris, one more time, where can they get their study?
Yep, you can go to our website, resonanceco.com/reports. It'll take you right there. You can download the latest America's Best Cities reports, also reports on Europe and our World City rankings that we've released over the last year.
That's great. And Myrtle Beach, number 5 on the small cities list. So we're very, very proud of that. And we appreciate you guys. If they want to find you personally, Chris, where can they do that?
You can email me at CFAIR, CFAIR, at resonanceco.com, RE. SONANCECO.com.
Great. And then Adsto Lamlaw, where can they find you?
Adstolamlaw.com. So first of all, Chris, I really appreciate you coming on, and I think it's a good service to the industry, the report that you guys put together. I don't see a path for DMOs or DMO professionals to continue to be successful in a silo. And I think if you're not a coalition builder, you're likely not going to be a DMO leader in the next 5 years, because this is a critical process change that needs to happen. And I appreciate you bringing it to light, Chris. Anybody can find me, Adam, at thebrandrevolt.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn or, of course, on Tourism IQ.
Great. And you can find me on LinkedIn or stuart.butler@visitmyrtlebeach.com. And we haven't plugged it in a while, but don't forget you can check out destinationdiscourse.com as well. There is a whole actual real handcrafted website by none other than Adam Stoker. So go check that out. Don't forget to leave a like, subscribe, reviews, all that fun stuff. And until next time, this has been Destination Discourse.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay, so if you want your Star Wars name, you take the first three letters of your first name, the first two letters of your last name, and that makes your first Star Wars name. So mine's Stubu for Stuart Butler. And then you take the first two letters of your mother's maiden name and the first three letters of the town in which you were born, and that comes up with your last name. So mine, I'm not going to tell you either one of those for me because I don't want you cracking my passwords, but my last name would be Hapem, Hapem. So Stubu Hapem. So please go figure out your Star Wars name. It's a lot of fun.